since we're clearly having a hard time scheduling the committees we now have, and we're going to have an extra one, if, as I expect, we approve this item. Is there a presentation to be made on this item?
The only person who can present anything would be myself, and I'd sort of like to get some of the other board members back before we do this.
It'd be nice if they were here.
Yeah. Can we move on to items B and C and then come back to A?
Okay, I suppose.
Is there any objection to doing that?
If you prefer, then we'll...
I'd rather have as many board members as possible here at the point that we have that discussion.
All right. I guess particularly Mr. Litton and Mr. Brown, who are members of the committee, should be in the room, Mr. Giancola being away on travel.
And the vice chair of the board ought to be here.
So that would be nice. Okay, so we'll move to item B. Are we ready on this one? Bus service adjustments.
Yes.
Mr. Kubitschek?
Yes. Yes, sir. We've got Mr. Riekwood and Mr. Hammer here for this.
Take it away.
Good morning, everyone. It's my privilege to be here to present to you some recommendations on some service adjustments for Metrobus and to obtain the committee's recommendation and the Board of Directors' ultimate approval of these changes that will help us respond to issues, service plans, and to generally respond to customer comments and keep our Metrobus service as high quality as we can. Moving on, next. Service planning efforts to improve operating efficiencies and adapt changes to ridership are continuous. We have a number of different studies, and we're constantly screening customer input, comments, et cetera. We have had several service improvements requested by jurisdictions as a result of various planning processes, and as a result, we're recommending these changes that would provide the planned service enhancements, adjust capacity to meet demand, respond to known problems and concerns, respond to customer requests and comments, anticipate some of our future needs, and most importantly, be cost neutral. Next. Within the District of Columbia, the highlights of these changes are the implementation of a new route, the X9, which would operate from Capitol Heights through downtown along the growing H Street Benning Road corridor, and would have the potential of reducing a number of transfers that have to occur at Minnesota Avenue Metro Station, and provide that limited stop service that was part of the Priority Corridor Network plan that was adopted a couple years ago. In Virginia, we have some service connections. These are three existing routes. We're trying to put them together in a way that will enable riders to benefit from a new way to cross the river. It is related and was presented as part of the Blue Line service adjustment package in a previous presentation, and we think has the potential of increasing Metrobus ridership there. And then we've been working with the City of Greenbelt and Prince George's County on a restructure of the Greenbelt area bus services, the City Council has voted support of that, and we have some highlight maps. Next, this is the proposed pathway of the new limited stop Metrobus X9 service. The next slide is the restructuring of the Greenbelt service. I'm happy to get into any particular details, but this is a cost and service neutral package, but it allows us to restructure the routes so that some of them can be shorter and operate more reliably. Some can be repathed so that they serve the circulation needs that were envisioned by the city. And also some route areas where we eliminated duplication so that there's better distribution of the service. And we right-sized some of the service to appropriate levels vis-a-vis the ridership. And lastly, the connection of the 7E with the 13B, which allows for a continuous ride from Southern Towers, North Farrellington, Shirlington, through the Pentagon into the Federal Triangle area downtown. And on the next slide, the similar connection with the 16F and the 13A that allow for a continuous ride through Pentagon into the Smithsonian, LaFont Plaza, Federal Triangle area downtown, providing renewed connections across the river. As part of this plan, because there have to be some additions and subtractions, we're proposing to modify service levels on some of the more minor holidays and to create some special day service reflecting the actual demands in the system. Rail has traditionally called them seasonal adjustments when they run shorter trains. With bus service, we can't run shorter buses, but what we do do is adjust schedules. And we'd like to propose a new service plan for Columbus Day, Veterans Day, Martin Luther King, President's Day, the day after Thanksgiving, and the week between Christmas and New Year's. These are typically lower ridership periods for us. In fact, the over the last 5 years, Martin Luther King Day ridership has been 52% of average. The President's Day has been 54%, Columbus Day has been 69%, and Veterans Day has been 71%. And so this adjusted service plan would provide the appropriate span of service, coverage of service, but also the frequency to meet the actual demands and loads carried. Also, as part of the general work that we do in tweaking here and tweaking there, we'll be modifying certain trips based on ridership changes, changes in schools, school locations, revised trip schedules and running times to reflect actual street conditions. Construction projects have begun that have had impact on our on-time performance, and you'll see this later in the vital signs report. Part of what we see with the on-time performance, this is how we respond to that information. And then lastly, we want to provide some resource to be able to respond appropriately as new projects come up, as we address the continuing detours that we have to do for what is a very vital downtown area here in the district, but it requires us to do detours repeatedly and regularly, and to maintain on time, sometimes we have to put some additional buses out on the street to preserve the service. All of this is subsidy neutral. The adjustments within each of the states is kept within each state, so there's no cross subsidy happening. Also, we've tried to provide to the best possible an adjustment between the additions and the takeaways to make it cost neutral and preserve the amount of transit service that's available to the region. And so then in conclusion, our recommendation is to approve these service changes that are specified in the attachment of the resolution and allow us to meet the current demands for service and establish new services consistent with regional planning projects. And this will all be effective December 19th, which will be the mid-year service adjustment that we have scheduled. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
In the table that you showed a moment ago, service efficiencies means cuts, and service adjustments and improvement and service performance means adds, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So the bottom two lines are the additional service you're putting in, which I'm not sure I understand the distinction between the two, but it's more service. And the top line is how you're paying for it by cuts.
Yes, sir.
The cuts being two kinds. One is reduced holiday service, and the other adjustments, which means cuts to some routes.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Couple of questions. On the table that's attached that shows the holiday, the way holiday schedules would be adjusted across all these different bus lines, there are columns on the right headed weekday, which I assume that means regular weekday schedule, and then one modified weekday, Saturday, modified Saturday, and no service. And for each of these lines, it shows you what we have.
Yes.
So I'm actually seeing what the changes would be. In other words, relative to regular weekday service.
Well, each individual route has a unique response. You can see the check marks for weekday mean that we would continue to run the existing weekday schedule for those services, and you can see that's
right. So
far and away the dominant.
If I
the modified weekday means we take the weekday schedule and in most cases reduce some trips from that schedule to meet the demand.
Okay, so looking on page four, if I look at the very top line is the T18 route, Annapolis Road. That route would continue to have a weekday schedule on those holidays?
That's correct.
Okay, but if I look at the W13, W14 on the fourth line, that would move to a modified weekday schedule.
That's correct.
This is page four of the attachment, attachment B.
Page number,
oh, I'm sorry, page 57 of 159 of the whole document. So modified weekday in that case means less than weekday.
Yes.
Okay. Another route, however, if I continue to go down and I look at the Route 1C, Fair Oaks, Dunloring line, that would run on a Saturday schedule.
That's correct.
In other words, the existing Saturday schedule would obtain on those holidays.
Yes.
Okay. But the next route down, the 2A, 2B, 2C, 2G, would go to a modified Saturday schedule.
Yes.
And modification in this case means?
We add a couple extra trips because there are times when the regular Saturday is not sufficient to meet a holiday demand, but the weekday service is too many trips.
Okay, so it's Saturday plus.
In some cases, that's correct.
In this case, it's Saturday plus.
Yes.
Now, modified weekday meant weekday plus.
Modified, in every case, the modified
weekday
means
minus.
A reduction.
That's right, I'm sorry. It meant weekday minus.
Yes.
And it always means a weekday minus on this table?
Yes.
It's modified Saturday in this case meant Saturday plus, but it doesn't always mean that on this table?
Yes.
Sometimes it means less than Saturday.
That's correct.
So this table really doesn't tell me what's happening to these routes.
Well, this table is prepared because with a bit of a production orientation, we start out, we have a weekday schedule built, a Saturday schedule built, and a Sunday schedule built. And when our schedulers go to make changes, we have to decide which of those we start with, and then we add or subtract. With the respect to the Saturday, in most cases it's an addition, but there are Metrobus is a broad system, and I don't want to represent that there isn't a takeaway that's appropriate.
Right, but if somebody were to ask me if this is approved today, you know, what we did, and I said, well, we're giving new service, but, you know, how are we paying for it? Well, okay, we're modifying the holiday schedules a bit. And they asked me, well, what does that mean? I actually work on a holiday, so does that mean my bus service is going to go down, up? What's it going to be? If I looked at this table and I saw that it would be some modified schedule, I wouldn't actually know whether they're getting more service or less service. So we, the members of the committee, don't here looking at this information, which we only just received, don't have any way of knowing whether we are adding to or subtracting from service on these routes on particular days.
Relative to normal weekday.
Well, relative to the scheduled weekday, the intent is that we would put out about 70% or around 900 buses instead of the 1,250 that we normally would put out. We've attempted as a philosophy to preserve the span of coverage. We've attempted to provide area of coverage. And we've attempted to provide enough frequency that it's still a meaningful service.
I'm sure you've tried to do your best. My question is just, if someone is saying on a particular route, what's happened to my route? On some of these, I can say, well, you're going to have a Saturday schedule on Columbus Day.
Yes.
And that's relatively straightforward. I can look at the Saturday schedule. Okay.
Right.
You know, if for all these routes that say modified weekday or modified Saturday, the answer is you might be getting more or less, and I don't know.
We'll be generating actual schedules for each of these, just like we do for those weekday timetables. And so that information will be specifically available to everyone.
I'm sure it will after we've done it, and it'll be printed, and someone will walk up to me and say, do you know you did this to my route? And unfortunately, I won't actually honestly be able to say I did. On the adjustments to routes, which means cutting out segments of routes to reduce their cost, there's nothing in here that I found, maybe I missed it, that says which of those are being done or how extensively they're being done. I know of one case, but I, of course, don't know all the routes. So how many routes are being adjusted?
Well, there's a summary table, which is page 53 of 159, attachment A of the resolution.
Oh, is that what that is?
That has a list of the specifics.
So it is only those routes that are being reduced?
That are being changed, that's correct.
Actually, this seems to include both the additions and the reductions.
Well, it's a comprehensive table.
Yeah, it is. So it actually is not a list of cuts because, for instance, the ones I know about, just look at the Virginia routes. The routes affected are 13A, B, 7E, 16F, H, and W. Now, in a couple of those routes are being changed in ways that add additional segments that don't exist. Those routes, some of those routes will go places they don't go now. That's new service. In at least one case I know of, there is a reduction. The route is not going to serve a segment it has been serving for years. Now, the only indication here is the table says restructure 16HW to improve service. I understand that is the goal, but one consequence of that is that people who live on one half-mile stretch or so of road are not going to have a bus. And this table doesn't say that. And that makes me wonder whether there are other instances on these other routes in which service is being eliminated in some stretch or other. I'm no doubt because you've analyzed it and think that it makes more sense not to serve that portion, but I don't know that members can see this, and I wonder if people are aware of any such restructurings that may be included in this action.
Well, there are, as part of the Greenbelt plan, there are changes that are, as you just described, where service is no longer being provided by Metrobus, but it's instead being provided by Prince George's The Bus, or the frequency of service has been changed in that segment, but done so as part of a comprehensive and a very well-vetted public process.
Speaking of that
there
process?
There is, just as additional information, the attachment to the MEAD has a table that talks about the financial movements of impacts of each of the actions. And that may help you see more clearly where the puts and takes are happening.
I'm looking at the table, and it looks to have the same line, restructure. I don't know how I can tell from that. I don't know how I would know from that that the 16W will no longer serve George Mason Drive between 4 Mile Run and Route 7.
I guess because we'll answer that question and say yes. The proposal with the 16W is that all those 16W trips would be converted to 16H.
I am aware of that particular one. I was using that as an example because it's, in fact, the only one I know. And it led me to the question of whether there might be other such restructurings in here that I would have no way of knowing about and wondering if anybody does. Mr. Linton.
Is the question here, what is the rider impact on the service change? And is that obviously known to you as well as the riders that's going to be affected?
Or the people voting on it today. I mean, you know, it'd be good to know. If you make a conscious decision and you say, yes, we're limiting service on this stretch because we think it's more efficient and we'll carry more riders over here, and we do it knowingly, that's fine. But I only happen to know about the one I mentioned. I don't know about any others that may be in here. There may be none. There may be a dozen. I don't know. And I don't know if my colleagues are on the table. I mean, the ones in Maryland, if all the Maryland members said, yes, we know about all of them and we think it's the right thing to do, that'd be one thing. I'm wondering whether anybody actually knows, other than staff, which of these restructurings have taken place. I'm wondering who else might know about it. And I was about to ask, what did the Riders Council say about the proposal here?
When we presented the Riders Advisory Council, all of these service changes were included in the public hearing process last spring, and each of the individual concepts have been vetted there. I do not believe they took a formal action on this particular package.
Okay, I think what you just told me was that all of this was part of the public hearing process last year, in fact, last fiscal year, for the budget year we are now in. So they had been proposed by staff previously.
Yes.
In exactly the form they're here now. There's no difference at all with what you were. You haven't changed anything since then.
Well, Well, the evolution of the Greenbelt plan is different than what we had presented back then.
Okay, so something very similar to this was part of the budget proposal.
Yes.
And so it was heard in the sense that everything that involved in the budget went to public hearing, and someone could have known about this. And then the board acted on the budget and chose not to take this particular recommendation from staff, and it was not included in the budget. Now you're bringing it back as a proposal for the board to act on separately, and there has been no further vetting of this. Is that correct?
There's been extensive public input vis-a-vis the Greenbelt plan. There's been communication with each of the jurisdictional staff regarding the continuation of and the evolution of the individual proposals. There has not been an opportunity to go back to the public in a general sense for input on these.
So apart from the Greenbelt plan, which is one particular route on this table affecting many, many routes in the system, there has been no further discussion with the Riders Council. There's been no public hearing. There's been no public forum outside of last year's budget process.
Yes, sir.
And when was this document available? If the public was interested in following, somebody was following this board's action and knew that we were having our first committee meeting since summer recess, and they went and looked for this document, when would they have been able to get it?
I believe it was this morning.
This morning. So not only the committee, but in fact the public had no way to see this before this committee met today and is asked to vote. Okay, anybody else have any questions?
This sounds like a deferral to me.
Not on the committee, but I do have a question because I'm thoroughly confused with the attachment B chart. The heading says chart shows changes from regular weekday service. So am I to conclude that everything listed on here is being changed from what we had before, or have you listed ones that already had changes for information on here? Or let me ask a more specific question. When I look at the 18 ENF out of Springfield and I see an X in the no service box, is there service today?
There is weekday service on that line.
Right.
And there will continue to be weekday service on that line.
Right.
On Columbus Day, Veterans Day, ML King, President's Day, and the other special days we've identified, there would be no service on that line.
At all.
At all. Instead, there would continue to be service on the one of the other variations of the 18 as an effort to maintain service into the Springfield area.
And like the others, you've made a conclusion on that based on the ridership.
Yes, there is, and that's why we maintain the modified weekday on the 18 PRS. That provides the connections from the park and rides, Side and Striker, et cetera, into Pentagon. And maintains access into the community for those days. Average weekday ridership on the ENF, I believe, is 180. On the holidays, we've been getting 40, 35. It's substantially reduced because a lot of those folks are federal employees.
That's fine.
Just a comment, not to specific lines. I'm not as familiar with those as others. But as a matter of principle, I don't think we should discourage looking at how to optimize the availability of service. And we really should be evolving it. It should not be frozen in stone, never looked at year after year. We have a limited amount of resources. We should be trying to do the best we can with them. I'll leave open the question whether the process has been appropriate, but I think it's something we really do have to do.
Mr. Linton and then Ms. Hulot.
I understand the some of Mr. Zimmerman's line of questioning. The one thing I will ask that when we did have the public hearings, except for the Greenbelt expansion or change, these items were vetted, correct?
Yes, sir.
Did we get comments from the public? I know that many of the comments were related to fare increases, service cuts in general. Did we get comments that related to these service changes from the public during this hearing?
On these particular service changes, not generally. There has been a continued dialogue on the disposition of the N8 route up in the upper northwest, and that email discussion has continued, but the in general, no. Most of these were not contested in the hearing process, and in fact, there were recommendations and endorsements of the concept of the modified service plan for holidays, for the minor holidays, including by the union representatives. Right. And so these are the types of things that we kept on the list as we evolved the package of adjustments.
Okay. You just elaborated. What did the holiday elements, was that commented on in the budget hearing?
Yes, it was.
Yes. If I could just add, Craig Simpson from the union spoke at every public hearing, or at least five of the six that he could attend. And the comment was basically related on the fact that we have a considerable drop in ridership but still provide a weekday service.
I was just trying to get a trace back in terms of the record, in terms of comments on this particular element of our budget.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hamry. There was considerable discussion back then during the budget process on, first of all, we were all concerned about not having reductions in service, major reductions in service. But we did, there was considerable conversation about holiday service and holiday schedules. And I do remember Craig coming out to the hearings, and I do remember, and in Prince George's County, there was considerable discussions about the bus service and and particularly Greenbelt. I was beginning to think it was a Greenbelt hearing as opposed to a Prince George's County hearing, but that was to Greenbelt's credit. And first of all, I do want to congratulate and commend WMATA for, and you, Mr. Hamry, and everyone for working with so closely with the Prince George's County Department of Public Works and Transportation, for working with the union. I remember Local 689 did comment for working with various citizens and groups in Greenbelt, although I'm not sure that all of them came to a consensus. But I know that, and then the state of Maryland actually supported these too. And I think for Greenbelt, these are what you really tried to do, and I think hopefully successfully, was to eliminate redundancy, to maximize the resources and work collaboratively with the County Department of Public Works and Transportation on with their routes, the bus routes, versus the Metro bus routes, so that you could eliminate that redundancy and just maximize. So I think we do not have a service reduction in Prince George's County. At most, what we may have is a slightly less frequent routes for some people, mm-hmm. but overall, better service for the majority of people in that area. And I know that was no easy feat, so I did want to commend you for that, and particularly since it's cost neutral, so subsidy neutral, so I appreciate that as well. But I did want to comment also generally that we really had a lot of discussion on this, on the issue of holiday service, and just so that we wouldn't eliminate, so we wouldn't have a major reduction in service, but I think there was considerable discussion on actual holiday service. Maybe because I was so intricately involved because of the city of Greenbelt, I do remember it vividly.
Well, and up until 2006, we had been running a Saturday schedule on these holidays.
Yeah.
But it was a source of a number of complaints because there's not enough capacity, especially on some of our major lines. Mr. Zimmerman may remember Columbia Pike, where on a Saturday we have 8 buses an hour instead of the normal 20. There's a real dramatic reduction in capacity, and so what we're trying to do with this is to find the right number. It's around 14 buses on Columbia Pike, for example, to meet the demand and do so efficiently.
That's a good point about the reason for doing this, which I'm not questioning, but you just gave an example where the result of the modification is to increase such service. Mm-hmm. But my point. simply that you can't tell from the table which ones are going up and which ones are going down. Mr. Costa.
Yeah, I just had a couple of questions. With respect to the holiday service, was Attachment B part of the public docket during the during our budget hearings? Because these are very specific recommendations. I know we spoke a lot about there's excess service available on holidays, but this is line by line. It also gave us a sense of what would be the nature of this.
Actually, Attachment B is a new document for this presentation. As we moved from concept to reality, we've been narrowing down the range of choices and being more specific. And now we've advanced this to the level of schedule writing so we could actually answer the specific questions.
Okay, so I think from the public standpoint, they didn't exactly know what was being contemplated in terms of service changes, especially the list that says no service. I mean, during the previous budget deliberations. My question here is, you probably have alternative services for the places where you're going to cut bus service on those days, but it's not listed here. It would give us some confidence that there is the presence of an option for our customers to take another bus route in order to get to their destinations if the service was not going to be in place during the holiday schedule. So I think what's missing here, I think we see a lot in terms of the actual service adjustment, also the cost implications. We never see an assessment in terms of the ridership impacts. And I think when we talk about picking out a piece of the service or a segment, I think it would be helpful for the board to understand, you know, what are the customers' options if there are any when that service is taken away, and then kind of what are the other ridership impacts that are associated with that change in service. So I think it would give us a sense that you know, we're looking at the whole picture. I think we're only seeing two sides right now, and I think there's a third component that's kind of missing from the mix here.
And we're happy to provide that. The challenge is that to provide the alternatives to the three dozen lines that aren't receiving service, that means I have to write three dozen stories and answer each one specifically because, for example, the 3T service that's reduced, there's 3A and B service, there's 28A service, there's all as options. And so there's a knowledge of the system that's required to
I understand
get to that point.
We would also need to explain that to the public on the days the services are in place. So I think at some point you're going to have to say, you know, on Columbus Day, here are your options.
And that can be part of our customer information as we put out the actual schedules and explain to folks how this can be best used.
Okay. Mr. Downey said earlier that, I forget the exact words, but something to the effect that, you know, wouldn't want to discourage staff from looking at, you know, creative ways to do things and all that. And I entirely agree. In fact, I don't know that I have a problem with anything in here. I'm not sure that I know everything in here, but greater concern to me is what other people may or may not know about what's in here because of what I see as a short-circuiting of the process by which route changes are made. Those are things that the compact requires public hearing for. And apparently, the interpretation being made here is that because this more or less was included in the budget proposal for the development of the current year's budget, that we met the requirement that the compact has for holding a public hearing. If the lawyer says that's legal, well, then that's a legal answer. But I think that there's more than just meeting legality. And when we make changes to routes, there's a reason that we have that requirement. And I think people need the opportunity to know what it is that's before them. I wonder if you're even sure that this document is, in fact, posted on the website right now. I'm not certain who has gotten to see this and review it. It may be, and I understand the additions, because that's what we focus on here, which look good to me. And there are definitely some you know, improvements to routes that I'd like to see happen. And this way of paying for them may also be good. But I'm personally not comfortable with the idea that we make changes like this without having the kind of input that usually improves a process like that. Usually people look at it and they say, it's a good proposal, but, you know, did you think about this? And we don't have the benefit of that. And that's what concerns me here. In any event, the matter is before the committee. You see what the recommendation is. Does a committee member have a motion to make? And those would be who are here. here today, Mr. Benjamin, Mr. Linton, or Mr. Brown, Mr. Giancola being away. Mr. Linton.
I'll move the staff recommendation.
Motion to approve the staff recommendation. Is there a second?
I second.
Mr. Brown seconds. Further discussion? I believe you're ready for the vote. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? No. The motion carries 3-1. Thank you very much. Next item is the suicide prevention program.
Mr. Chair, we do now have enough.
I know, but we're going to do this one first, and then we're going to go back and figure it out.
Great.
Who's going to present this one?
Mr. Baldwin.
Mr. Baldwin. Not sure that we have previously met Mr. Baldwin at one of these meetings.
Pardon?
Have you presented before to this committee?
Not formally yet, no.
In that case, welcome.
Thank you.
And proceed as soon as you're ready.
Joining me here is Lisa Cooper Lucas from the Medical Services section of Human Resources. And we're here to talk about the suicide prevention program. There are two documents. One is the MEAD and of course, the presentation. Basically, the purpose that proposed board action is the development of a suicide prevention skills program for Metro employees. And this is to position key members of Metro staff, particularly those on frontline positions, train operator personnel and station managers and others with increased knowledge of suicidal behaviors and to be able to enhance the recognition of certain behavior patterns of people who are at risk. That includes employees and customers. And to increase our competence within Metro to intervene when we see those kinds of behaviors. The action item that we are specifically bringing forward is approval to initiate and authorize a competitive contract for a suicide prevention training program for one base year, and there is an error here on the slide. The MEAD actually provides and was modified to provide for two option years for completion of training and continued expansion of the program. Just as part of the background, as you are probably aware, Metro has experienced an increase in the number of attempted suicides and actual suicide from July to 2009 to the present. That is an issue that was identified earlier, and we are now in a position to bring this program forward to help address this problem. We are currently collaborating with the D.C. Department of Mental Health, the American Association of Suicidology, and the Toronto Subway System, which has a bona fide program of this type in place to gather information on what is the best way to proceed and to rely on their expert advice to help guide us in the preparation of statement of work and ultimately putting a program in place. Our recommendation is for the board to approve our proposal to initiate and award a competitive contract for a suicide prevention program for one base year and, as I said, not one, option years for completion of training and continued expansion of the program. The last slide indicates the actual phases that we would incorporate in this plan. And essentially, it is based principally on first training the trainer within our own organization. So we would use the consultant resources as a result of the award to position key people that we have already pre-identified, covering people in bus, human resources, MTPD, rail, and safety. They would form the initial train-the-trainer group. We would hope to be able to do that, assuming board approval, to move forward sometime in November and into December. We would also then use that group in conjunction with the contract personnel to do an initial set of training of bus and train operators and station managers, also beginning in December and into January of 11. We would also be framing as part of this package a communications plan involving employee information regarding suicide prevention and signage and other public awareness campaign that would mesh with that. And that would be scheduled for December through January of 2011. Throughout this process, we have built in a rigorous program evaluation to assess the effectiveness of the training that we are providing. That would be done initially after we've completed the train-the-trainer component, but we would also be doing it in terms of a program evaluation at a post-training phase, and then again later after we've had more chance to see how successful not only the training awareness piece is, but our intervention pieces that go along with that. That is the proposal. I'm available to answer questions with Lisa Cooper-Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Baldwin. I'm sure there will be some to help move us along. I'm going to start by moving approval of the recommendation. We can make that the base if there's a second.
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Benjamin. And now discussion. Mr. Grant.
I've listened very closely to what you've said, but I still don't know what you're doing. I mean, can you describe succinctly for me what is the nub, what is the heart of this program? What are you going to do? Are you going to just tell me what this?
Well, let me make some general response, and then I'll ask Lisa to add her comments because she has worked very closely with the experts in this field. From my perspective, what we are attempting to do is to position our workforce, frontline people who have general interactions with the public, particularly in train stations, because that's where we are experiencing the difficulties, but to position our staff to be able to, one, recognize the kinds of behaviors and indicators that might show very clearly a person who might be predisposed to attempt suicide or to actually commit suicide. And then also to provide them with some basic intervention skill sets that they might be able to use when they actually confront that kind of situation in the station. And then the third and more general kind of interest that we have is being able to have a broader set of communication, not only for our employees, but for our passengers in terms of alerting them generally to some of the concerns in this area and also alerting them to certain steps that they can take, either in further information or assistance that might prevent suicides from happening.
So does this program envision a physical restraint of people who appear to be in the process of contemplating
suicide? I don't believe so, but I'll ask Lisa to answer that question.
No, it does not. The program actually is a win-win for the public as well as for Metro, in that we're looking at stopping something that oftentimes appears and feels to be inevitable. So we're looking at conversations with the public, not only one-on-one with our personnel and the people who potentially might be thinking about or planning to suicide, but also with our riding public to be a part of the intervention. Statistically, it's been shown, and even in the review of the videotapes after events, we've seen that people have cased particular stations. And as a mental health professional, I have debriefed a lot of the station managers as well as the train operators who've experienced jumpers. And one thing they always say is, I saw them last week, I saw them 2 days ago. So part of that is identifying that behavior and beginning to do something about it proactively, address the concerns that they may have with the individual. And the entire project is very comprehensive in that we've also partnered with jurisdictional mental health programs, and they have crisis response teams. So the plan is, a part of the plan is to initiate conversation with people who appear to be troubled or planning. If in fact they confirm, which statistically, if you address it with someone who is planning suicide, 9.9 times they admit that yes, this is what I'm thinking, then the crisis intervention team from that particular jurisdiction can be activated. And there are also plans to provide ongoing support for people who may or may not have insurance or medical benefits through the jurisdictional mental health programs.
Well, were any architectural, structural options considered?
Yes. When I went to Toronto last month to talk to them about the success of their program, they are actually rolling out barriers the first part of next year, which admittedly they said it took them quite a number of years to get to that place because it is extremely expensive. I've also spoken with the medical facilities in the London system who are planning to do so, and they've already done so in Paris. And all of them have said, you know, they're doing it because of the number and the frequency, but it took them a number of years to come to that conclusion.
In Toronto, haven't they been at this for like decades now at this point?
The program that I participated. I actually got some training while I was there. It's been 5 years for them, and one of the people who was assigned to partner with me throughout the two days that I was there was actually writing her doctoral dissertation on the evaluation of the program, so it was very helpful in talking with her. And so for the 5 years, she's actually done outcome studies on the number of suicides they've been able to prevent, the number that have went on to be completed suicides, and then those that people perhaps weren't suicidal but were approached and what their response was. And there hasn't been any negative implication from any of that activity.
But the specific program you're talking about is 5 years, but my impression was that Toronto had a very severe problem way back.
Oh, yes.
And so that they had been struggling with this for some time.
Oh, definitely.
When I've spoken to people in the service provider community, suicide prevention folks here, they pointed me to Toronto initially as a place that had a staggering problem at one point, and that over a period of time has been apparently successful in significantly reducing it. And that was part of the reason, and I saw that in your presentation, that they seem to be the developers of best practice from what I've heard, so that seems an appropriate place to look. But I think, you know, getting to the barrier point is the result of a lot of years of thinking
right
about it. And platform screen barriers in particular, you know, are going in place around the world in various places, not just because of this, but because of the generalized safety issues when you have large numbers of people
right
in stations, which in many of the world's systems, as crowded as we think ours is, there's some of them have been very crowded like that for, and more for a long time. So I think there are places in Japan doing this.
Right.
France in a number of places, and I believe in the future that's the direction we're going to go. But I also know that it's a very huge capital investment, and we all know about our limitations there, so that's not happening anytime soon. So the question is whether there are limited things that can be done nonetheless that can make a positive effect, and that's, you know, what I've been told by people who work in this. I think it's important that we're doing that. We'll do evaluation. I take it from the presentation, I hope I understand correctly, that the intention is, you know, after you've done a year and presumably at the end of the second year, you're going to see and evaluate how effective this has been.
Yes, that's our intent, and to do as full and complete an evaluation at various stages as possible.
And my interest is not only that we evaluate in terms of do we think we had a positive effect on reducing suicide, but that you're gonna do training with employees as part of this. I mean, it's obviously a big part of this. And so one of the questions is that training effective? And are people after a year or two of doing this actually able to continue doing the things we expect them to do as part of this program?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
The training is actually twofold. It's not only evaluating the efficacy of the employee's skills and ability once acquired in the program, but also the outcome of the applied skills and how it has impacted the public. Mm-hmm. In fact, is the public actually participating as well? Are they assisting in the interventions? Have there been reduced suicide? So it's sort of a multi-tiered evaluation over time, and it's not just after a year. We'll be doing it after each training, and then again, once those people have been deployed and if they're actually activated.
Very good. Other discussion, Mr. Lincoln?
Let me first just kind of commend you for what seems to be a fairly thorough analysis of the possibilities here, because at first blush I was wondering if this was kind of pie in the sky, recognizing that it's a major problem, but wondering whether or not there are firms available that actually have done this in a real environment, and we actually have, you know, kind of a source of thought. There are firms that actually do this, that as we send this RFP out, we can expect response.
Yes, there are two firms that I'm aware of that have actually done this in the rail environment, and I got those referrals from Toronto, who are actually working internationally as well.
And there may be others out there that we're not aware. We will do, as part of the bid process, make sure that it is known that we are seeking competent contractors for this, so that will be part of the bid process.
Other questions?
I just want to, you know, I understand the budget issues and so on very, very well, but it sounds as though someone might be able to say that we are adopting something from Toronto that they have already realized is insufficient. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, if they're going to barriers and gates, that would suggest to me that the program that they had otherwise in place wasn't working to the extent that they wanted it to work. You hear what I'm saying?
I do hear what you're saying.
And so, I think in this particular, when was the last suicide in our system?
August, last month.
That wasn't long ago.
Right.
And. I don't know. I think that we might want to tackle some of the patterns here in a targeted way. You know, the only other experience I've had with this was in D.C. The Duke Ellington Bridge was a favorite jumping place. And the only way we stopped it was to build fences on the bridge, which is aesthetically not pleasing, but it worked. And there haven't been any suicides off the Duke Ellington. But it had taken on, it had become a favorite kind of thing, place to go to, if there's such a terminology. And I think when prior to the suicide, the first suicide after June 22nd, 2009, how long had it been since we'd had a suicide?
We had had suicides at least one a month or one every other month prior to that. And statistically, and I was familiar with the Duke-Ellington Bridge, so I did some research on that as well, the suicides at a neighboring bridge increased. So it just, it suggested that where I can't, I don't have access to this.
There are other bridges.
There are other bridges. Yeah. But I do hear what you're saying. It's not so much that the program hasn't had success. It hasn't had the quality of success that it would, that it's trying to achieve, because the goal is to stop all suicides, and that just is an inhuman feat, actually. And so recognizing that, they are going to additional measures, but just like Chairman Zimmerman mentioned, they are also doing it for other reasons as well in terms of their system. But I think what we're also saying here is that the public is saying do something, and we've been able to look at how we can incorporate the riding public in our solution. And I think that also is something that will give us not only the credibility that we hear you, but it also offers us the opportunity to partner with our riders in a way that hasn't been done before. And I'm frankly very excited about the thought.
So it's not true then that we've had a dramatic increase in suicides since the 22nd of June 2009?
It's been a dramatic...
Compared to prior...
Well, it's been a dramatic increase in that there were clusters that happened after June 22nd, which also statistically suggests that because there were a number of deaths after the accident, that people who were considering suicide considered that a viable option because it was completed deaths. So that was seen as another vehicle.
How many suicides were we having in
June? We were having maybe four, five, six maximum a year, at least every other month. And after the 22nd, we had almost one every month. And at one month, we had two to three.
But didn't you just say we had that in the few months before that also?
Every other month, we had maybe totally five or six throughout the whole year.
Obviously, all of this is fairly speculative. But isn't it true that suicide is correlated with things like the condition of the economy and that when, you know, we have a recession and high unemployment,
and holidays,
it tends to go up?
Yeah.
So you know, what we have in the significance of 2009, as much as anything, is that the economy was plunging into recession and unemployment, you know, in our area, you know, soared, and we also saw suicides rise. And to my knowledge, that is a pattern that we've seen over the years. You know, if you've studied the economic cycle over the past 30 years, say, that you would find that pattern. Is that not correct?
That is part of the correct. I was just given some statistics. For 2009, we had 11 suicides, so that was almost one a month. In 2008, the prior year, we had five.
Yeah, and if you looked over a 10-year period, because obviously those things jump around a lot.
Right. But you're absolutely correct. Everything you named is a factor in the whole suicidal process. However, the repercussions of how people suicide not often has the public impact that this does. It's devastating not just to the family of the deceased, but the people on the platform, the operators, the station managers, the electricians, and I can tell you the number of train operators with whom I've sat and debriefed after this process. It's devastating to their families as well.
And I think all that speaks to the need for the agency to do something about it. We are not going to solve the problem of suicide, but we can contribute to the reduction of this tragedy and the impact it has directly on the people who ride the system and who operate the system, as well as hopefully, you know, some of those who are the immediate victims as well. Ms. Hutchins.
You've kind of paralleled it. I just think we should move forward. I think we have to have a starting point. This is a good starting point of us being able to act. It's not a solution for us because it's a larger societal problem. It gives us an opportunity not only to work with our customers, but if we think of crime, we think of the same thing. We're not going to solve it, and it's not the same everywhere. But because we are part of a larger community, we play a role as well, and this is the role that we can play. We will not solve the problem, but we can surely be, comfortable that we've contributed to trying to find a solution and to prevent as much as possible. So I think it's a good start for us. We have to start somewhere. And we've had enough, I think, information to let us know that it's present with us, and therefore this is something that can help us start to address it.
Well said.
Further discussion? Motion is to approve the recommendation. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much.
Thank
Thank you.
All right, we're now going to go back up top and take on the item that involves the change to our procedures and mission statement that will create a new committee if approved, and that will be a good segue into the next part, which we will discuss, safety. Mr. Benjamin, I would ask if you would present this and move its approval. And
I shall do so.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. As you are all aware, one of the recommendations made by the National Transportation Safety Board applied directly to our board and was a recommendation made to us relative to our mission and relative to our policy and relative to our way of carrying out our business. If you turn to page 5 in your packet, you see the resolution that we are going to consider. The second whereas recounts the basic principles of what the National Transportation Safety Board proposed for us as a board, which is different from what they proposed for Metro in general, which we also have a responsibility for. There are three resolves at the bottom of that first page, which in effect do the three things that we are considering here. First is Attachment A. Attachment A is the mission. It modifies the authority's mission. The second is our procedures, Attachment B. And the third is a committee membership for the change that our procedures are considering. If you go to page 7, we have on there our current mission statement and the proposed change. This was actually proposed by staff and has been modified a tiny bit, but you will notice that it emphasizes the importance of safe, reliable, and effective transit service. Okay, so it really expands on our role somewhat and makes it abundantly clear that we have a commitment to safety, to reliability, to effective system, to enhancing mobility and improving the quality of life in our region. That's the first part. Okay. Second, if you go to Attachment B, page 8, at the very top, it again says that same safe, reliable, and effective. One of the areas the National Transportation Safety Board noted was the fact that our own board procedures did not recognize the importance of safety. And so that has now been modified to make sure that the commitment that I know we all have to safety is reflected in the document. It's at the top of page 8 as the role of the WMATA Board of Directors. In passing, since the opportunity was here, and all of you have seen this before, there's a change on page 10 which splits out what we used to have as administrative items in our board agenda into consent items, the ones that we move en masse in general, and other actions, because we have had things that have come through that clearly require some discussion, and that would distinguish between those. Getting back to the whole issue of safety, if you go to page 13, the change that gets made is in the board committees. This is section 8 of our procedures. It takes the functions of safety and security, which are currently within this committee, and moves them to a new safety and security committee. And that's the change that goes on page 13. Page 14 actually specifies what that safety and security committee will do. It takes the basic things that the National Transportation Safety Board talked about and expands them somewhat to make it abundantly clear that this is a major oversight role of this board and of this committee, and that this is a function that we will, in fact, carry out fully and significantly. The section below the definition of what the Safety and Security Committee does just deletes those same functions from this committee. On pages 15 and 16, we deal with the issue of the meetings of the committees. This change defines the Safety and Security Committee as a committee of the whole. Again, emphasizing the importance of this to our entire board. Since we already have one day on which we all meet as a committee of the whole, and that is the same day as our full board meeting, this schedules the two committees that meet as committees of the whole for the same day. So we just go from one meeting to the other as committees of the whole. There is a change to the calendar to show that and to update our calendar for the changes that we made earlier. And then finally, at the very, very end, very last page of this, page 31, is attachment C. And it, again, now lists all of us as members of the committee of the whole and would appoint Mr. Downey as the chair of that committee and Mr. Linton as the vice chair of that committee. So those are the actions. They are designed to take what I believe is our commitment to safety and make it abundantly clear and make sure that we are operating in a manner where we emphasize the need for this board to focus on safety and safety oversight. I'm now prepared to move this item.
Please do so.
And I move this item.
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded.
Mr. Graham.
Thank you very much for this action, and thank you for your very clear explanation of it. And I'm very supportive of this. Because, of course, you know, we had a safety committee for many, many years, as we all know. The only question that I have, because I chair the other committee that has a committee of the whole structure, the real estate, is the quorum issue. And we have come close to not having a quorum or even the prospect of a quorum on one occasion. Do you think it makes sense to revisit the issue of the quorum for these large committees so that we don't end up with a situation where the committee is unable
to meet? This is actually a discussion I had with counsel at one point about quorum when we meet as a committee of the whole, and the recommendation that came out of that was do what it says in the compact relative to the whole board meeting, because that's basically what you're doing. We certainly could reopen that discussion, and if that's the case, we could go back to this and look at it again. But I'd like to make sure we move ahead with this and do that as a separate item, which we certainly could do.
Okay. Could we do it that way? Like, can we think a little bit more about it, move forward today, but think just a little bit more about that?
Absolutely.
As we think about it, can we think about both committees, the quorum?
Yes. No, I would do it in that context of, you know, if we have committees of the whole, is there a reason to have a different quorum? And if so, what does that do relative to the compact?
Thank you.
Just following up on that,
Mr. Downey.
The question of the quorum would be if the committee is taking an action or simply to be able to meet.
To meet? Yeah.
But you can meet.
No, you can meet without a quorum. You just can't act without a quorum.
You can't convene the committee.
Yes, you can.
Yes.
The board, the board cannot convene, but the committee can convene. It just can't act.
It just can't act. But a lot of it's reporting. So, Ms. Hutch.
No, Mr. Downey was making my point. I think, and I think the other part is that I think the care of not requiring a quorum, and I think the emphasis here is that to act we need a quorum, and therefore the diligence lies with the committee members.
I have one more comment to make before we vote under the assumption there are no more questions.
Any further questions, Mr. Venture?
If we send this to the board, and I would presume whatever vote there is in this committee will pretty much reflect what the board action will be, since almost all the board members are here, I think what we will have done is not only responded to what the National Transportation Safety Board has recommended, but we will have created a framework for dealing with safety and safety issues and security issues. In my mind, that's not enough. It's one thing to create the framework. It's the second thing is to use it. And the challenge that will be before us is to use that framework in order to do the oversight that is called for here and to really be effective in improving safety in this organization. And I think that's a challenge for the board and an important challenge. And in moving this item to the board, we would take the first step in meeting that challenge.
With that, motion is before the board for approval. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No, that motion carries unanimously.
Not mine.
Thank you, Mr. Benjamin. And that is a natural point for us to move into our information agenda and the key items, which are the safety report, which we will presume received from Mr. Doherty in a moment, and then the discussion of the Tri-State Oversight Committee, who Chairman Zimmerman and members of the board. Thank you, sir. I'd like to present the safety report for the, actually through the month of August for you. And as we heard, there's a good chance that this may be, oh, sorry, I won't be able to see my papers. Okay. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, the purpose of the report is to provide the Customer Service Operations Safety Committee an update on the safety actions completed and underway, as well as an update on the open corrective actions to date. I'd like to begin with staffing. The Department of System Safety and Environmental Management has currently a total budgeted positions of 58. I believe we'd even mentioned at the last meeting, though, we have hired a new Assistant Chief Safety Officer, as well as most recently a new Deputy Chief of Rail Safety, and the original 12 vacancies have now been filled. Bus Quality Assurance Office moved over to the Safety Department on July 1st of this year. One of the recommendations during the FTA, made by the FTA's Office of Safety and Security during their audit that their report was presented on March 4th, addressed the actually the Safety Department's education and experience. And our consultant has prepared an assessment, and actually what shows the department includes personnel with advanced degrees in safety, electrical engineering, environmental engineering, business administration, other safety, engineering, and technical business-related fields. And on an average, the safety staff has 17 years of transit experience, 10 years of safety experience, and 13 years of experience working at WMATA, providing the department a strong depth of institutional knowledge. And again, this was provided to us actually through an assessment of a consultant that actually went through and interviewed the entire safety department and looked at their resumes and qualifications and past experience. The assessment summary also indicated the safety department has highly skilled individuals with diverse backgrounds, including certified safety and security director through the WSO, or the World Safety Organization, senior associate staff instructors with the Transportation Safety Institute, and a professional engineer. The box to the right of the display actually provides additional technical expertise found within the ranks of the safety department, but I won't go through all of them, but as you can see, there's a variety of actual various different expertise held by safety staff currently. Moving on to training. A lot of training activities has been going on. In fact, as we speak, there's a rail system safety course going on at the Carmen Turner facility that concludes tomorrow after a week-long training of various staff from WMATA that have attended the training. But to date, we've concluded the transit system security class, the FTA track inspection class, effectively managing transit emergencies. A week before last, the rail incident investigation course. Rail system safety that I mentioned is underway now. We're looking at it's a special actual session looking at trends in system safety with the Transportation Safety Institute. And then upcoming, we have the transit system security class, the SEPTED and design review, which is crime prevention through environmental design, as well as the fundamentals of bus collision investigation. And on top of those courses, which are being put on for us by the Transportation Safety Institute, in October we're hosting a taproot class that assists in determining root causes through incident investigations. And that's another specialized course that I believe will help us identify root causes and corrective actions to move forward as we move to get better. As far as the safety survey, we believe that that has been a successful undertaking. We expect to come back to the board sometime in late October, no later than November, with a report on the results of the safety survey that was conducted by the Corporate Executive Board. So we're looking forward to the results of that survey going forward. Moving on to the FTA audit. There were 10 findings directed towards WMATA, as well as 5 directed towards the TOC. We did file a response to the FTA Office of Safety and Security that did find all of our activities as open and acceptable.
we held a meeting, next slide please, on August 5th with the FTA safety and security staff, presented the courses of action that we were moving towards, and the FTA found that our course moving forward was acceptable and did reply with a response, again, that our actions moving forward were moving in the right direction, and they found those actions acceptable towards those findings. We are continuing to work to close all the FTA findings as well as all the other findings going forward. We move on to the corrective action plans. Today, the slide actually.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Downey.
That's a quick question on the previous slide.
Yes, sir.
I didn't understand it. Third bullet, second sentence. It says FTA accepted the information towards closure of findings in August. Does that mean they were going to close them in August, or they accepted the information in August?
It was accepted, sir. They're not closed. They're all accepted, but we had time frames associated. We had August deadlines or timeline and October timeline.
So we still
timeline.
Look forward to a point where they will respond with closure?
Yes, sir. Okay. As we actually successfully close them. If I could, moving on to the corrective actions, and this slide has actually been is outdated at this point in time because of the meetings this week with the Tri-State Oversight, and currently we have 33 open items and 233 closed items that actually was decided or discussed at this last meeting, in which 8 more items were closed, and we have 2 items pending, which would actually take that down. However, now keep in mind that the triennial audit findings in that report that I anticipate Mr. Bassett may provide more information after my presentation, then the numbers will go up and we will continue working towards closing out all of the corrective actions. This gets, as I just mentioned, the Tri-State triennial report was completed, submitted to WMATA. WMATA submitted a response that was due just this past Friday. And now the Tri-State Oversight Committee will consider our recommendations for potential modifications to their draft report and assemble their final report, and we anticipate receiving that sometime towards late October, early November time period to close out the, actually their report will move forward expeditiously, which we're doing now, to close out any open corrective actions. Pretty much just mentioned the preliminary report that we did submit our response on September 10th. If I could, and I believe we're going to move into the statistical data now, if that's okay. Looking at this slide, presents for you the rail passenger injuries on board for the last 2 years through June 30th of 2010.
And Mr. Daugherty, and since everybody has this stuff, why don't you go to anyone that you think is significant that should be pointed out, and the members can ask about any ones that are of particular interest to them. There being many pages of these that we haven't had the chance to see beforehand.
There are, as you know, several pages in the document that discuss the suicides. One of the things I think certainly that's it's noteworthy, and it would be on the rail transit facilities occupant injury slide that
page with 86 in the document.
I'm sorry? Page 86, I'm sorry.
And you're highlighting this in particular because?
Because actually that the injuries are down 38% compared to 2008, are up, you know, from 33% from 2009. But we are working on these injuries, looking at what we can do as far as any campaigning in stations and parking facilities. Move on to and the slide that's relatively new, just to let you know that we are including some rate information for you, because I believe that providing accident.
Page 87.
Total preventable rail rate. Total preventable rail rate. title total preventable rail rate.
Okay.
We're sorry, John.
91, I believe, is total preventable rail.
I was moving over to, yes, to page 91, just to show that we are including some rate for all collisions, the preventable rail collisions, as we're looking at all of our modes to actually start looking more into preventability and also following the National Safety Council standards for determining accident preventability, so that we're actually applying a standard. It's not that the slide necessarily, you know, provides you any data other than we are now including the preventable data for your review and information.
Well, you only go up to June here, but presumably at this point you know what happened in July and August.
I'm sorry?
July and August, I presume you know what goes in those boxes.
Well, that's what we don't have that. As we're looking at getting all the data, it's one of the things that I'm working on is getting the data available to us, unless it's the specific incidents that we're looking at starting to review with you forward coming. But right now, actually, the data hasn't been made available. We don't have all the data to put together the rate with a mileage or the total number of passengers.
I mean, with the exception of August of 2009, the numbers are all zero or one. And so, you know, we're talking low numbers of things. So I figured just there either was, you know, in May and June, there were none, which was good considering there was one a month or 4 months before that. And I was just wondering what the trend was, which July and August, did we have any of those?
Yes, good. Ken, do we have that?
So
still zero, right?
So you think you got actually four good months of no incidents?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Some of the, on the very next slide, fire incidents 92, just to provide you a little information on yesterday's incident. That was found that somebody actually dropped a cigarette butt through a grate, and it ignited the debris at the track level.
Yes, there's some clarity I'd like to do on that.
Okay.
I'm sorry?
Sergeants and then Mr. Grant.
You said someone dropped a cigarette butt through the grate, and I guess we should say where, and so that it's clear where.
Near Gallery Place, I'm sorry. Near the Gallery Place, there's.
It was in the station area, in the platform area, where?
Can you provide that information?
The incident we had yesterday was actually at an air shaft on G Street between 9th and 10th Street.
Okay.
The grate that's right in front of the library. People go out there, congregate on their breaks, whatever it is, and it dropped down.
So you're saying it happened outside the station?
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is very
somebody outside the station did that. It shut down Gallery Place and Metro Center for a while.
It's Metro's problem.
That's correct. It was actually on street level. It wasn't associated with the station. It's an air shaft that goes from the tunnel up to the street level. And the grating above is obviously based on the number of cigarette butts that we found below as a congregation point. And some debris that was inside of the landing at that location ignited, presumably through a cigarette butt and dropped down.
As it happened, came through those stations right after that, I guess, not knowing what had happened, but coming out, and there were people around, and there was a smell. And I remember, what was that? And then I found out afterwards about the situation. But I think this one is significant. I'm thanking Ms. Hutchins for asking the clarification, because like everybody else, I just heard, oh, there's a smoke incident, something burned, you know, and, you know, here's something else breaking on Metro. In this case, it doesn't look like that's the case at all. We're entirely impacted by somebody outside the system, but it's your problem, you have to fix it.
I'd like to add to that. The debris shouldn't have been there in the vent shaft.
Yeah, the debris is our problem.
So Dave has taken action to make sure that's cleared up. So there's something we should not have been doing. We did. It was something, you know, a person outside the station, you know, dropped a cigarette butt back, but should not have been there. If it had not been there, we wouldn't have had the problem.
It just illustrates that, you know, our system is not an entirely separate thing. It integrates with the broader community, and there, you know, there are a lot of responsibilities here, some of which, you know, obviously is in the system, and some of which, you know, is the result of what other folks do.
Sure. Just looking at the fire one, unlike some of the others, the trend here does not seem to be good. And I wonder if there's a sense of what, are there root causes here that are causing a rate that's roughly double? Incidents is roughly double what's been in prior years?
Talking about page 92?
Yeah, the one before.
Okay, that's an area that, again, in the June timeframe where we did have, you know, where we were having a spike and an increase. We have adjusted, you know, our cleaning practices. We did go through a period of time where we reduced some of our onboard, you know, cleaning manual of overtime and everything else due to some of the budget items, and we evaluated to say that that was going to have a potential impact, which it did. So we're in the process of catching back up. We have added two additional vacuum trucks, so now we actually have, you know, three throughout the system. A lot of that gets back into, again, with material and overall debris that we're working on this has been brought up before this, you know, community before, where we're starting to trend the information as far as a fire at a light lens, where somebody takes a newspaper and throws it on top of that, and it eventually smolders, you know, versus we actually have like a stud bolt fire. But we are seeing a lot of materials that we're trying to eliminate from the process. And if you notice, like a tree trimming and a lot of the work and stuff that we're doing is those very things, because we have a lot of external materials that do attract their way to the track bed, and we have a problem with that. That's what we're really focused on besides the system issues.
You know, one of the issues that has gotten an awful lot of public attention and a great deal of NTSB attention is what has been referred to as safety culture. And the conclusion has been advanced by the NTSB. I don't remember their specific words that they used, but that they're, in effect, that there's an absence of a safety culture at Metro WMATA. And now I assume that these trainings that you're having, all of these very impressive trainings that you're having as addressing the issue of increasing, if not the safety culture, safety consciousness. But I would be very interested in knowing what your general comment is on this, and how your current strategy will address it.
As far as response, you're correct that the training is certainly part of addressing a safety culture, and it was one of the things that we discussed at the DOT FTA's Transit Rail Advisory Committee on Safety last week, was the safety culture. In fact, NTSB board member Sumwalt also made a more detailed presentation at that session. But certainly my general interpretation is that to improve the safety culture is to where every employee realizes that safety is their responsibility, and they have not only the right but the responsibility to actually bring safety concerns, safety hazards forward, and take an active role in resolving those hazards so that it is safe for not only themselves but for their other employee, for their co-workers, as well as the public, and to where they don't ignore something. I guess, for an example, you see, you know, a safety hazard, which may be far-fetched, but it's not far-fetched with a kink in the rail. Somebody sees it, doesn't report it, and then we end up with a derailment. So it's actually ingraining safety into everybody's behavior, I guess, if you will, that it's a behavioral practice, and that's the culture, so that everybody understands that that we all have an active role in safety, not just the 58 members of the safety department. And it starts certainly at the top of the organization with the board and our general manager, to where that it's learned and that it's also one that's accepted throughout the agency, and folks are feel free to report issues without retaliation or any kind of disciplinary action, because they report something, and that management listens to what they have to say, that it's a two-way communication in closing the loop to improve safety for everybody.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Linton, and then Gary.
I just want to make a comment, Mr. Brown. You were not here this morning when they had the presentation on the rail rehab intervention, and Mr. Kubitschek made a very clear point in that, where it had a very aggressive safety effort through that process. And one of the side benefits of that was where the employees themselves started embracing it by the employees taking intervention themselves with their colleagues to make sure that, you know, if they saw something that was kind of crossing the line or something that was putting them at risk, that they took the initiative to call that out to their peers. And that's the kind of broad continuation where there's a cultural change that, you know, safety is part of everybody's responsibility, and they're protecting each other and
Yes, just wanted to, you know, add to this, and again, in terms of culture change, attitude, and a respect, you're saying that, you know, it's not only just in your safety department with 50-some employees, it starts at the top, the general manager, but we have 10,000 employees in the system, and I know in your presentation you talked about, you know, in terms of responding to a talk and the NSTB, that, you know, we're training at the different levels of training that have been completed or will be occurring. And what was noticeable to me was that it really didn't address how we're getting to the full workforce. Because as you say, you know, whether you're riding the train, you're walking in stations or whatever you're doing, everybody has a responsibility, including the passengers, the riders, to always be of safety conscience. And, you know, if you fail to do that, then, you know, we're all to blame.
Let me just say a little bit on that. There's a number of actions that we're taking, have been taking, and I'll enumerate some of those. But importantly, the board has commissioned a safety culture assessment by outsiders, and I think that will help us get an even broader overview on everything we should be doing as a strategy. But let me just enumerate, and Jim, feel free to jump in. What has been going on for some time and has been stepped up is the idea of safety conversations, and this gets to the employee out on the floor, the you know, person driving the train, the person driving the bus, the mechanics, where that we record and keep track of every safety conversation that goes forward, and we expect that there be so many safety conversations that go on. I will tell you that I had a safety conversation directed at me on one of my trips out one night where, and this is to give you an example of what safety conversation is about. We were walking back on a platform, and there was some tools on the platform, and I chose to step over the tools and continue on my way. And the gentleman that was there from that's working there came over to me and said, you know, it's possible that in stepping over, you might not have stepped all the way over. You could, almost like a cartoonish thing, stepped on the shovel and smacked yourself in the face. That's an example of a safety conversation where people are encouraged to have these. And I go to a safety, what's the title? No, the other one, the superintendents that come in.
The superintendent safety
action. Superintendent safety action committee meetings. And there's three groups. And what is it, sort of like a CompStat meeting? And certain people are picked to stand up and talk about what's going on in their unit with statistics. And one of the statistics is, how many safety conversations are you having? And they have to be above a certain level. And if that's not occurring, then there's a discussion, as there was at the last meeting in one case, about what are you going to do to get it up where it should be? And, you know, sort of peer pressure as well, so I guess me being there. So, you know, that's one example of really trying to spread it out. And the reason we have these superintendents' safety executive meetings is so that we do go through certain particular statistics and see, and people talk about what they're doing to improve, or if they've been successful, what they've done to make themselves successful. Again, that's at one level. And what is emphasized by me and others at that meeting is this has got to extend back down all the way through the workforce. And it's not a one-way conversation where there are also safety committee meetings going on in the different facilities where the mechanics, the drivers are having meetings to go over what local issues there are, with the idea that those local issues are resolved locally and not much has to be gone back up. But important to that is that there's feedback to the employee of what is being done, or if there's something that can't be done, why not? Will I sit here and say that's all going on perfectly? Absolutely not. But that's the kind of things we're doing. And then there's a safety executive committee meeting, which I attend pretty regularly, where at a higher level, and we're actually moving the agenda on that from what was more a general discussion of safety to, again, specific performances, specific incidents, and what's being done about it. And I would say in the last month or so, we've just moved into that kind of agenda, and we have to develop it further. So those are some of the things that we're doing to spread the message that safety is important. It's just not production. It's just not getting trains in service. And I will just to add a little further on this past weekend, Labor Day weekend, when we talked about the safety, What has been going on, and what went on especially that weekend, aside from the supervision and management focusing on safety, is the safety officers now are out in the field, visiting the field, and they, along with the supervision, were there all weekend long, and that sends a message to people that we're really interested in. The last thing is, and I'll stop talking, is that by the investments that are made by, approved by this board in state of good repair and in safety issues, that sends a terrific message to the employees that there's really an interest in doing something better here safety-wise. But there's more, a lot more to be done, and it's got to take years to get the culture where you want it.
Well, I appreciate both what you said, Ms. Stout and Ms. Searles. I think of that, too, as taking it out to the public, and how do we have the public have that discussion? Because I think, and one we could have had this morning, and could have had this morning, and the person that decides to leave their paper on the platform and not in the receptacle. But how do we continue to have that? Because our public needs to understand the urgency we have about safety. And to me, the best way is for some way to engage them in order to have that same discussion. And that's the part that I really hope that we can get to in this process.
I mean, one of my hopes for the safety committee is that, in fact, we can use it in that regard, that it's not just responding to others and checking boxes, but really encouraging what is going on within the authority and making the point that at the board level and general manager level, it's what we want to see more of and be aware of what the effectiveness has been. So it's not just a reactive effort. One of the things that I'm always told and always think about is we shouldn't even take the absence of major accidents as an indication of safety. That we really have got to look at how the system works and how we're taking every possible effort to prevent things that can happen.
I totally agree with you. And if I could possibly respond to Ms. Hudgens' comment, is we are looking at creating safety messages that would be played, on platforms and through the radio system to our customers. We're looking at evaluating our safety pamphlets, our website, and looking at a lot of different ways of what we can do to get the message out to the public so that they are aware that they are a part. We need their cooperation, we need their partnership in order to, to continue to ensure that we're safe.
I didn't know if there were any others you wanted to highlight. I noted that the preventable bus collision chart on page 98 and the table for the companies in particular seems to show a fairly significant improvement overall in this category. And again, I don't know what previous years look like, but just looking from 2008, there's a significant reduction in preventable collisions from 2008 to 2009 of about 17%. And if the 2010 trend were to continue in the second half of the year, we looked at the first half of the year, there would be another 7% drop. So all in all, it would show about a 22% reduction in such collisions.
That's other. Don't really have a other than I believe that through the safety conversations, possibly, and the impetus on safety, and I think that the bus folks are responding well. We're looking at that. We do have some areas of concern with some of our bus-on-bus incidents of recent and things along that line. But certainly, the good part is a downward trend in the preventables.
I don't think any of us feels like we're where we need to be yet, and I trust that you're working hard on that. I thought it was worth noting because, in fact, this organization has been very concerned about safety for some time and has been struggling with issues, since well before June of 2009. And specifically on the bus side, there were particularly grave concerns back in 2006 and 2007, which did lead to a number of efforts that were made. And this may suggest that there's been at least some success in that area. There's other data we ought to be looking at on that. I'm sure you'll show us.
We're going to. We're actually delving into that as we actually, we went live with a safety measurement system, as we call it now, which is our database for the bus side, and we're working on bringing it online for the rail side. Actually, now it's just in the training mode, that we believe that that data will be beneficial to assist us in trending and looking where our strengths as well as our weaknesses are.
Thank you. Now's a good time, I think, to move to the Tri-State Oversight Committee's audit and to ask Mr. Bassett, who's been waiting. Thank you for waiting. Sorry for how long it has taken. But I think since you've been listening to the meeting, you know what we've been discussing, and I think it is appropriate preface to what you have to tell us about. Thank you, Chair, for joining us once again.
Before we start, I just wanted to comment that I thought the presentation we just received was a very large step above what we have been getting in the past. It's a quality presentation with a lot of good information and put into a pretty good context so that we have a real sense of some of the things that are going on, and it's well done.
Yes.
I wanted to note for the staff, we like what you're doing.
I agree, Mr. Benjamin. Thank you for noting that. Thank you, Mr. Daugherty. We're not necessarily through with Mr. Daugherty since he has interest in this presentation, and I'm sure it's around if there's any questions that come up. Good afternoon, Mr. Bassett.
Okay. You can just move.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Chairman Zimmerman, for the introduction. My name is Matt Bassett. I'm the chairman of the Tri-State Oversight Committee. I work for the Virginia Department of Rail and Public Transportation. For those of you who aren't familiar with the TOC, we are the FTA-mandated state safety oversight organization for WMATA. If we could go to the next slide, we'll be just doing a brief overview of some things which Mr. Daugherty and Mr. Sorrells have already mentioned, as well as some additional issues that we think both deserve commendation and others that we think deserve attention and additional effort. As Mr. Daugherty mentioned, we conducted our triennial review in June of this year. This is a comprehensive audit in which the TOC, as well as a team of consultants, audit Metro's compliance with its system safety program plan and its security and emergency preparedness plan. These documents are required by the TOC program standard and procedures, which is the document we use to guide their safety and security, system safety and security operations. And in turn, our program standard is dictated by 49 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 659. We completed the on-site portion of the audit in late June. We completed our draft report in early August and sent that over to WMATA staff so that they would have the opportunity to review it, to draft up any comments they might have, and to respond to us in case there were particular areas of concern, thoughts that we may have gotten it wrong, or we may not have all the information, or they'd prefer to see something in a different manner. And we're currently considering those now. As Mr. Daugherty said, we are planning to finalize the document and return it to WMATA in October. That will be made public on the week of October 4th. We don't have a specific date yet, but we will have a completed audit report on that week, and it will be a public document on our website. And as you may already know, WMATA is obligated to develop corrective action plans when we issue a finding, as well as when they identify safety and security concerns through their own internal auditing or hazard management processes. Those corrective action plans have to get approved by the TOC. Now, there are a number of findings, regardless of how the report is going to shake out, but WMATA has the opportunity and the administrative flexibility to develop corrective action plans that address multiple findings, as well as to bring to the table as corrective actions efforts and various activities that are already underway, rather than reinventing the wheel for a particular audit finding. When they may already be aware of the problem, they may already have processes in place to address it. Again, final report will be out the week of October 4th, so if we could go to the next slide, please. Thank you. In terms of the significant progress, and obviously, as Mr. Daugherty mentioned, there's been a lot, the significant progress that we really like to highlight since April 8th is the substantial additions to the safety staff and the available expertise that they bring to the table and the engagement that they've had really across the various activities of the authority. As a reminder, the Tri-State Oversight Committee doesn't oversee the safety programs that handle bus or paratransit. It's not part of our federal mandate. However, we can say that for their efforts on the rail side of the house, the new personnel, as well as the expertise that Mr. Doherty mentioned, has really been helpful in bringing folks who are technically conversant into conversations that they might not have been a part of in the past, really increasing the level of situational awareness, both of safety's perception of how the system is being run and in the perception of the operating departments about the level of knowledge and ability of the safety personnel who are becoming more a part of their everyday lives. It's worth noting that the Right-of-Way Worker Protection Manual and the Metro Safety Rules and Procedures Handbook, both major documents which guide how the system operates, were signed in August at the Executive Safety Committee that Mr. Sarles and Mr. Doherty mentioned. The Right-of-Way Worker Protection Manual was developed as part, as we mentioned in our April presentation, was developed in response to a number of right-of-way worker incidents and some fatalities as essentially an overhaul of the processes and procedures used to protect workers on the tracks, bringing what WMATA did more into compliance, or I shouldn't say compliance, more into conformance with, for example, the American Public Transportation Association standard for railway worker protection, which I understand is still being finalized, but they had a draft available to them, as well as the Federal Railroad Administration's Part 214, which lays out a generally accepted practice for how to set up rules and procedures and activities to keep workers safe out there. It's also worth noting that the RWP process was really a landmark in bringing in personnel from safety, operations, rail transportation, track maintenance, as well as outside agencies such as the TOC, the Federal Railroad and Federal Transit Administration, invited observers from Amtrak and freight railroads, as well as a number of site visits to other transit agencies, which really broaden the perspective of the group that put this document together. We're happy to see it signed. And the Metro Safety Rules and Procedures Handbook is the broader document that addresses all rules and procedures and also standard operating procedures for the rail side of the agency. And that had a number of open corrective action plans pegged to it due to NTSB recommendations that a new Metro Safety Rules and Procedures handbook be updated and completed, as well as FTA recommendations and audit findings. The important thing to note about that is that obviously when you're revising the rules of the document that govern how people move and work and communicate, and are disciplined and rewarded for how they do their jobs in the operating system, you really have to get it right. And this has taken a long time, but its signing is a milestone, and we had the opportunity to review it and be a part of the process, and we appreciate that. Another thing that's really worth commendation is that Mr. Sarles' expressed goals and the hard work of the WMATA staff when it comes to the regular closure of open corrective action plans has really made sizable progress. I think what you're starting to see when you take a look at the hard cap data lately is that the programs and the plans that are still open, that still require effort, are more and more long-term significant projects to address a systemic concern rather than administrative plans that have fallen by the wayside that simply there was no pressure for the work to get done. The low-hanging fruit are being rapidly plucked from the tree, as it were, and we're very pleased to see the progress and attention, and we look forward to supporting their efforts and continuing it. As Mr. Doherty mentioned, the triennial audit will add a number of corrective action plans to the matrix. It's worth noting, as the board of directors for this agency, that that doesn't represent a sudden spike in safety concerns or a sudden dereliction of duty on the part of the folks responsible for closing them out. It simply represents that those findings have made their way onto the matrix and that the efforts are underway to address them. So I would ask probably the next time you see us, you will see more corrective action plans on the matrix and that you take that into account when you evaluate it. The last thing that I'll talk about in terms of the really significant progress before I wade into a couple more details, and I certainly don't want to keep you all here all day, is that the internal audit and accident investigation programs have seen significant improvements. As Mr. Doherty mentioned, they've brought on a consultant who's really helped them to step up their proverbial game when it comes to the activities by which they assess safety internal to the agency, by which WMATA staff go out and take their own rules, procedures, and plans and say, are we doing what we're saying that we're doing? And a recent audit in late August of their rail car maintenance programs and procedures was really a milestone in advancing this activity, which is required under the federal regulation, but in the past had seen some real deficiencies in terms of effort and energy directed towards it. Accident investigation is also another area that we've seen really significant improvements. The additional personnel within the safety department, the additional expertise and flexibility that they have to assign personnel to accident investigations, as well as working out operating agreements with the operating departments and law enforcement about who's going to be the lead agency in the event of certain accidents and incidents, as well as the simple allocation of assets that now the safety department has available to it, or I don't want to speak to, you know, your vehicle fleet quite yet if it's not kitted out yet, but the safety department is going to have vehicles available to it that it didn't in the past, equipment available to it, communications gear that will really help it do its job more effectively. And we see that as a very boots-on-the-ground representation of the agency's additional commitment to safety in the last couple of months and years. Could I have the next slide, please? I sort of jumped ahead of myself on my slide, so I'll sort of gloss over this. But the rail car maintenance audit and audit was audit in late August was a significant accomplishment. Going forward, the two caveats we would ask that the board and WMATA keep in mind when it comes to conducting internal, and by I mean internal safety audits. I recognize you guys were here speaking about finance and administration early. When we say internal audits, we mean internal safety audits as laid out in our program standard and procedures. It's essential that the agency continue to ensure that the 30-day submittals deadlines to the TOC are made. We're required by the federal regulation to review and approve the checklists used to conduct these audits. In the past, there's been some difficulty with ensuring that we hit that exact timeline. That's very important to us so that we, for us to validate the process before it begins. And the most recent one, there we were pretty close to 30 days. Moving forward, we need to make sure that we hit that. But that's a small concern up against the major progress that's been made. And long term, the agency needs to keep in mind that when conducting internal safety audits, as they're doing right now, with the heavy support of very skilled and very proficient consultants who are assisting them, that the safety staff who will be here for the long term are gaining the training and expertise and comfort level with conducting these internal safety audits that will allow them to sustain this level of proficiency in this task down the road once the consultants, you know, terminate their contract and, you know, perhaps once, you know, there's some folks leave and some folks arrive, we need to make sure that the safety department and the agency in general are proficient in conducting these things, you know, 2, 3, 5 years down the road. Next slide, please. The RWP program, as I mentioned, it's a major success. This has led to the closure of several corrective action plans that were associated with the right-of-way worker protection program. This, of course, doesn't signal the end of our interest and involvement in right-of-way worker protection nor WMATA's. There's a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of rolling out training and in terms of evaluating the effectiveness of this new program once it's actually in place and mature. The one thing I would ask that you strongly consider is that sustaining the new right-of-way worker protection program includes a significant amount of training required. It goes above and beyond the levels of right-of-way worker training in the past. There's a tiered system of depending on the employee's job duties and requirements for performing the task of maintaining safety on the track bed, there's progressively more training required. This, of course, requires people. This requires time. So it's important to note that after the major push this fall to get everyone trained up to this level, there will need to be a long-term commitment of resources from some area. We don't make that decision. Obviously, WMATA does. But we want to ensure that this training program, not just the development of the rules, but the training program to ensure compliance with them, is fully staffed and funded. Next slide, please. The accident investigations, as you may know, prior to the arrival of the newer management team, there had been a significant backlog of open accident investigations. Accident investigations that the TOC is responsible for and to which we delegate our authority for investigation to WMATA as per the standard practice for most rail transit safety oversight agencies. Accident investigation criteria are laid out by the federal regulation 49 CFR Part 659 and reflected in our program standard. And a number of reportable incidents over the course of the last 5 to 6 years had gone uninvestigated, or had they been uninvestigated, or they may have been investigated, but the reports were never submitted to us as the oversight agency. There's been significant progress made in addressing this backlog of open accident investigation plans. WMATA submitted an aggressive plan as part of the response to the FTA audit on July 30th, in which they committed to closing a number of the accident investigations within certain time frames and tiered them based on the level of difficulty and administrative effort required to complete them over the next 30, 60, 90 days. The first planned submittal is on the 26th, which I believe, if I haven't lost my calendar, I think that's a Sunday. But we'll take the Monday submittal on the 27th. That'll be quite all right. That is the first milestone by which we look forward to gauging their progress in addressing open accident investigation plans. And it should be noted that their efforts in closing out the old accident investigation plans haven't hindered them from robust and continued investigations of more recent incidents. But we look forward to reviewing their materials on the 26th or 27th, depending on whenever the email shows up in our inbox. We have the next. Thanks. As you know, the Tri-State Oversight Committee is established under a memorandum of understanding that was originally signed in 1997 between the Secretaries of Transportation for Maryland and Virginia. Actually, for Virginia, I believe it may have been the Director of Public Transportation originally, and the Director of Transportation for DC. As in response to the FTA audit, which was conducted in December 2009 and issued in March 2010, the FTA, as well as the NTSB, expressed a desire to see the TOC gain additional responsibilities, or I'm sorry, additional enforcement capabilities, additional administrative latitude for the members of the Tri-State Oversight Committee to act more quickly in critical safety situations, and essentially to have a more robust communication network to senior leadership, whether it be the Federal Transit Administration, the WMATA Board of Directors, or what has now been created as the TOC Executive Committee. The Executive Committee is the Secretary of Transportation for Maryland and Virginia and the Director for DC. That memorandum of understanding was signed on Monday. It included, as well as formalizing the communication lines and some administrative stuff for within the TOC, it included an additional enforcement mechanism by which the three TOC executives committed to, in the event that all other options in dealing with a critical safety failure at WMATA had been fully exhausted, they committed via their signature to sanctioning, to providing their willingness to sanction the authority through the state contributions to the capital budget through suspending, delaying, or ultimately canceling such contributions. Again, it's included as a last-ditch enforcement mechanism in response to the concerns of federal agencies that are, and the public, that our oversight committee had minimal teeth. And it's certainly not anticipated as something that would be thrown around on a regular basis, but it is now codified within the establishing document for the TOC. Thank you. In that vein, we continue to work with the WMATA staff on developing kind of a corollary MOU through which we could agree to address several administrative issues, including the question of enforcement mechanisms. There are some difference of opinions that remain on a few items between us and WMATA staff. The three TOC executives met with Mr. Sorrells on Monday to discuss the remaining points of concern between the two agencies, And there will likely need to be some board participation to facilitate the compromise on those remaining points, but that's really a work in progress at this point. This is sort of a placeholder. Thank you. As Mr. Doherty mentioned, the TOC participated in a joint, as he mentioned the initial audit response, we participated along with WMATA in an in-person meeting with FTA to help update them on the open audit findings that we had, as well as that WMATA had, after the issuance of their March 4th audit. We shared follow-up documentation on our own activities, and we sent that in on the 13th. We have some additional follow-up pending with them, and we will be posting those documents on our website once we complete the submittals. The documentation that we have on our response to the FTA audit will eventually need to be submitted to NTSB simply because that is our sole recommendation from the safety board, that we comply with all recommendations and audit findings issued by the FTA. So we will, of course, be doing that. Next one. In terms of major project participation, two of the major undertakings within the Rail Operations Department that we've wanted to get involved with have been the procurement of the 7000 series rail cars and the development and procurement process for the loss of shunt ATC backup tool that's being developed with ARINC. With the 7000 series rail cars, after some discussions, we were able to get access to the stakeholders meeting that are being held on a regular basis. We're satisfied with the level of cooperation we're receiving there. We've been invited, but we still need to get the logistical follow-through on the regular meetings for the ARINC tool, as I mentioned earlier. Our second full-time TOC member, whom I have neglected to mention, I apologize, Jim, the TOC hired our second full-time member from Maryland in July, and as Jim Benton, he's sitting there in the back, he is brings a long rail car maintenance and transit operations resume with him from the Maryland Transit Administration. We're very happy to have him. And it also my understanding that DC is in the interview process of hiring their full-time TOC member as well. So that's certainly a positive development for us in terms of the full-time resources we have available to our committee. Moving back to this, Jim is going to be regularly receiving and evaluating the loss of shunt data reports that come from WMATA per some of his discussions recently with staff. And that's very important to us to have our finger on the pulse of how the agency is continuing to manage this concern. Next slide, please. We've had good access and continue to have good access to the capital program and safety certification processes for the major rail projects. It's very important for the Safety Certification Review Committee, which is a staff-level organization, to continue their oversight of major capital projects on behalf of the authority to ensure that the safety certification programs are being performed with the diligence and in conformance with the WMATA rules and procedures about this critical process that they're required to do so. We've also been participating in the Dulles Corridor Metro Rail and the Infrastructure Renewal Program safety certification activities, and we're pleased with the level of access and information we're receiving on those. Next slide, please. I wanted to take a minute to note our take on the Executive Safety Committee. The recent developments that Mr. Sarles and Mr. Doherty mentioned with the Executive Safety Committee really deserve a little bit more commendation, simply for the fact that the previous incarnation of the Executive Safety Committee, and it is the ESC, not the SEC, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure we'd gone back and forth on that. The previous incarnation, called the SSEC, had a very ambitious charter in that it would review major accident investigations. It would gather reports from departmental and local safety committees, discuss them at the senior leadership level, and it wasn't able to, based on the attendance and based on the management of the committee, to fulfill its responsibilities. And the Executive Safety Committee, from what we've seen, is well on its way to doing exactly what the previous committee was trying to do. We're very pleased with the fact that senior leadership is sitting down to talk about recent major accident and incident investigations. I think the important part is to sustain the high-level priority and participation on this that has been so instrumental in really turning it around. So it simply needs to be sustained. One of the issues that we wanted to bring up, the ongoing concerns we have, is that there have been a series of incident investigations and discussions that we've had with WMATA about door issues. And there's different kinds of door issues. You have the, quote, doors off the platform, which is generally a result of a station overrun. You have wrong side doors in which, for one reason or another, the doors open on the opposite side of the platform in the station. And you have doors open during train movement. We're continuing to gather some data via the safety department and rail operations. We have some concerns about, we're trying to learn more about the process by which wrong side doors, as in when the doors open on the opposite side of the platform and expose the passengers to the third rail side of the vehicle, the process by which that's detected, reported, and otherwise investigated. We understand, based on a report that came in from a blogger, that there was such an incident of wrong side doors on the Mount Vernon Square station on August 25th. And we're working with WMATA staff to gather more information about that. And we've got some, actually got a whole bunch of it yesterday, and we're going through it. They're different issues from a technical perspective, and they often get lumped in together under just general door problems, some of which are technical. The 4000 series, for example, which we'll talk about in a minute, was a technical concern about bridging an electrical circuit, whereas, for example, doors off the platform or wrong side doors could be a human error question. But we're monitoring these closely. We want to ensure that we've had our we're doing our due diligence, and WMATA is doing theirs as well. Can we go to the next one, please? One concern that we did want to bring up is that during the process by which the 4000 series doors were removed, they didn't remove the 4000 series doors, they removed the whole rail cars, that would have been a problem. The 4000 series were removed from service on, I believe, early July 3rd of this year. And initially, we had really great follow-up and information sharing and access provided by WMATA staff. The WMATA personnel provided very timely and helpful initial information. They facilitated conference calls for us to learn more about why the 4000 series were being pulled from service, which I believe you've already been briefed on this previously, but essentially there was the potential for a phantom circuit to be created through the door motors of the 4000 series rail cars, leading to the unlikely but possible occurrence of uncommanded door openings during train movement. The authority provided us with conference calls and provided access for a contract engineer to visit a shop over the July 4th weekend when just about everybody was having their barbecues. WMATA personnel were helping to show our personnel around, and that was great. Now, the concern is the follow-up. On July 6th, we requested some follow-up information on the processes by which the agency made the decision to remove the cars from service, as well as a copy of any maintenance procedure being used to fix the identified problem. It took us a significant period of time to get a copy of the maintenance procedure. It took us 20 days, and we got a series of conflicting answers. There was one, there wasn't one, there was one, but it was draft. Before it was ultimately provided to us on the 26th. It took us until August 16th to get a full answer on the processes by which the decisions were made to remove the cars. This goes to the point, essentially, that while there is significant improvements in terms of the communications capabilities and the engagement between the Rail Operations Department and the Safety Department, the authority must become comfortable not just providing the answers to us and to outside agencies to the safety problems that it has developed, but beyond just providing the answers, it has to become comfortable showing its work. And that's our level of engagement as a rail safety oversight agency. We do not become prescriptive about this is what you ought to be, this is what you ought not to be doing. We simply need to ensure that when there is a major decision made that has a safety impact on the system, that there has been, that we can validate the process by which those decisions and choices have been made. And that was what the difficulty was in this incident. We it should be noted that we were able to speak directly with Mr. Sarles as well as with the TOC Executive Committee about our concerns and how long it was taking the information to get to us. We believe that significantly added to the responsiveness, and that if we hadn't had access to both our executives as well as to Mr. Sarles, it might have taken longer. And we're very pleased with the ability we've had to increase our communication since then. We believe it was a learning experience, and the follow-up requests we've made about these have been treated with very significant priority. We're pleased with that, but it's simply worth noting as a case study. Next, please. The TOC public presence is going to continue to grow. We're going to be posting additional documents on our website. Mm-hmm. We're going to be conducting live chats, taking a page out of the WMATA media relations playbook of having individuals available to answer questions via the via our new website. If you're not familiar, we'll throw the URL up in a moment. But we've migrated our website from a slightly difficult to find page on an agency website to www.tristateoversight.org. It's a little easier to remember. The page is laid out much more clearly, and we've got a lot of good documents and correspondence up there, and we look forward to increasing our engagement with the public and gathering information through them as well as maximizing our own transparency, which is a directive from our executives. We will be testifying before Congress next week alongside both your board and WMATA staff. And we also attended the Federal Transit Administration Transit Rail Advisory Committee for Safety that Mr. Doherty mentioned earlier. We'll be continuing to participate and monitor it, even though none of our personnel are appointed members to it. The work of the TRACS, it's worth noting, is an advisory committee to help develop regulations for FTA once their legislation, which they hope to pass, if it ultimately passes, the TRACS will help them develop binding federal regulations that will guide the development of safety programs across the country. So obviously we have a significant stake in that, and we'll be participating with them as well. I believe that's all we have. This is our website, and I'm more than happy to take your questions and comments at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Bassett. Before I turn to members for questions, let me just note that with the action that we took earlier, this activity will move to another committee next time. I want to thank you for your work over the past year in helping this committee and beginning this new relationship. It was a thing that had never been done before. There had been no contact between the board and the Tri-State Oversight Committee. And among the many things that people on all sides of this issue have been trying to do to improve safety, I think this is an important one, and appreciate your having come here to provide regular reports and give us that extra insight. I also appreciate your meeting with me personally and helping me to understand things. As I said, with a new committee, there will be a more complete focus on this, and this will move to that committee. So again, thank you. Let me start with Mayor Yule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the presentation. And again, I commented to Mr. Downey here that now we have this new safety committee. We can be obviously more engaged. But I think also what could be of service to us as board members and members of the new committee, again, I'm not one member of a board that wants to, on a daily basis, be micromanaging the system because we don't have time to do it. We don't get paid to do it. But because this is so important, and I know how things work in my government, local government in Alexandria, and when folks complain and say, well, staff isn't responding, staff isn't doing this, well, I can't get staff to respond to something if I don't know anything about it. My suggestion that I'm offering is, perhaps as often as you make requests of staff, can the board be copied so that we can see this, your inquiries in a more timely manner? Because if, like you pointed out here, it took 20 days to get a response to something, that's just totally unacceptable. Not that we can make it happen sooner, but certainly we'll be cognizant of it. And I don't know what the process and your procedures are, but I, for one, would like to, see it.
If I might.
You can think about it. You don't have to respond.
I would. It's certainly something we would take under consideration, but my preference off the top of my head is to ensure that we give WMATA staff, as we've done in the past, the latitude to handle these things and really only contact you guys when we think there's a real problem.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Benjamin?
If I remember what you said, Mr. Bassett, I thought what you said was as soon as you did elevate it, as soon as you made sure that the general manager knew there was a problem, you got immediate response. Was that right?
We got a very timely response when we elevated it to the
general. In fact, the system worked and worked well.
50% of that got us an immediate response. The other concern about determining the decision-making process was a little bit more of a murky question, and that took an additional couple of days. So I wouldn't lay that at the general manager's feet. I would lay that as a complex question.
And one of the things I've had experience with, and I'm sure you have also, is decision processes are often not very clean, and they are, in fact, murky. And the final decision is clean, but if you want to know who said what to whom every step along the way, that may or may not be an easy thing to get. So I can certainly understand that that could be different. And I also remember you saying something about difference between what you heard first and what you heard later. And as you know, one of the things that happens whenever there's an incident of any sort is the initial reports you get generally get modified as they go a little bit into the system. So my concern would be if you never got something good or you got it so late that it didn't, you know, there was nothing you could do with it. It sounds as though what staff did was what happens in a real-world situation, and that when you raised issues, staff did, in fact, respond quickly, you know, not instantaneously. It takes a little while to do things, but did, in fact, respond quickly. So it's not clear to me what the issue is that you're looking for and what we as a board ought to be doing. You're saying, at this point, you're saying, no, we don't really need to do anything.
At this point, the issue is resolved. I brought it.
Okay.
Under the original tasking that we were given by this subcommittee earlier, the request was to bring not just successes but concerns as well.
Oh, yeah.
And that was I certainly don't bring it up as a way of saying this is still an active issue. It's not. The issue had a beginning, middle, and an end. But it's something that was of concern to us, so we wanted to ensure that it was brought to your attention.
Thank you for bringing it to us.
Thank you. Mr. Daly?
Yeah, I will follow up with you on the new committee and so how we will obviously continue to work together.
Certainly. Very good. Mr. Litt.
One question, one point of information I would raise is that since we will have corrective actions and there will be spikes from time to time between corrective actions and the closures, that it might help to date the responses so that we know that those are, in fact, closures to corrective actions that have taken those over mm-hmm. appear. So when we see the spike, it does not appear immediately like nothing's going on and things are getting worse. So if you can track that in a way with time, it would help in that report.
Aging of receivables.
I would add, if I may, as Mr. Kubitschek proposed in a meeting yesterday and as had been discussed with some of our staff, we're going to be sitting down with WMATA staff in the next couple weeks to come up with an improved mechanism by which we track these documents, and I'm sure we can take that, by which I mean corrective action plans, I'm sure we can take that into account when we put this together.
But I was also speaking to Mr. Daugherty in terms of the reporting to the board, so that as we're reviewing the closures and the corrective actions, that there's a point in time so we know the date of those actions. So if we see a spike, it doesn't look like this is continuing to grow, and we're not taking the appropriate action. I meant to make that comment as you were presenting earlier in the day. So I just thought I'd do it.
Thank you, sir. Good. Okay. Mr. Bassett, thank you once again.
Quite welcome.
And thank you for your continuing work on this most important area to our customers and the region. Colleagues, we have only remaining two informational items, the presentations for which we've already received. I would suggest that we perhaps forego the formal presentation here. If we have any specific questions, we can, of course, directly approach the staff upon adjournment, which I would suggest, since it's coming up by 1:30, we might now want to do. Any contrary opinion? If not, we will conclude then. Thank Thank you very much. The committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.